Hello, I'm Dan.
I'm JJ.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles. So welcome back to the Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction. We are on part two of a two-parter on the great French locked room mystery writer Paul Holter. JJ in the last episode tried to convince me to begin to read his work, and I'm being drawn into it. So this week he's going to give myself and you listeners out there who may have not come across or read Paul Holter yet, five books to get yourself started. Interestingly, you wrote a number of years ago on your blog, before I started blogging and before I'd read a lot of impossible crime fiction actually, one of your five to try posts, which is about five books, general introduction from one author to get them started. Has that changed much?
That was nearly 3 years ago. It was February 2016 that I did that post, and it's now December 2018.
Interesting.
So they were Death Invites You, The Phantom Passage, The Demon of Dartmoor, The Seventh Hypothesis, and The Tiger's Head were the five books that I picked back then. I've picked another five now. I've gone through my shelves and I picked another five, one of which was not published back then when I did that post. So that plays a certain part in that decision. The fact that this is an especially good book shows a lot of what he does particularly well. Mainly, I think my intention back then was to try to get a bit of a spread, because I think you are more accepting of an author when you get a sense of their range. I know we have a tendency to want to read one book by an author and then want them to just keep writing that book. To want, as I've said before, John Dixon Carter write 15 Till Death Do Us Part, or every Anthony Barclay book to just be the poison chocolate, solution to the poison chocolates case, another, you know, just the poison chocolate case volume 400, where he's some ridiculous solution to it. But at the same time, you also want to see somebody diversifying, you want to see that range. And so I was trying to cover a range of stuff then. I'm interested to see what my perspective on the five books I've picked out now will be, because I haven't thought this through, so I'm just going to... Just fly in and see what happens.
So expect 2.5 hours of meandering conversation.
2.5 hours, you want me to be quick about it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, we have to cut it down. All right, so let's get into it. So let's go through chronologically. We're going to start with The Fourth Door, published in 1987. So his first work?
His first work.
Tell us what it's about, The Fourth Door.
It's a slightly confusingly staged narrative, which I think is something you see slightly more in Holter's earlier work, where he doesn't have that initial grip on how to set something up. Essentially, it devolves down to a couple of impossibilities. One of which is, as I mentioned in the previous episode, a man is locked in a room, the fourth door along a particular corridor, behind the fourth door along a particular corridor. The room is locked, the wax is put over the lock, and a very rare coin is pressed into the wax to ensure that nobody's going to be able to break in and cheat the locks. When everyone goes up a little bit later to unlock the door, there's a dead body in the room, but the dead body is not the man who was in there initially.
Brilliant.
Secondly, there is a no footprints murder, where someone is found murdered in a house and there are no footprints in the snow around it. There's a lot of other crazy stuff going on inside of it as well, but those are probably essentially the two core impossibilities on it. The actual plot structure around it is honestly a bit difficult to describe. This was my first experience with Holter. This was the first Paul Holter book I read. It was an early translation for Locked Room International. And actually, I've got 500 posts coming up, I think, in February. And I'm thinking for post number 500, I'm going to go back and reread this and then kind of re-examine it in light of the love affair that I've gone on with Paul Holter since reading it.
Yeah.
So I'm really interested to read it again and get a bit more of a grasp on precisely what's going on.
And see if you would still recommend it by the end of that post.
Yeah, didn't think about that. Yeah. Good point.
And so why would you recommend this as a starter one?
Because it's really creative. The essential trick of the fourth door murder is really, really canny. It also shows a great use of minor instances around. For instance, there is a seance in this where people are putting messages in envelopes and the messages are read by the psychic without having opened the envelopes. Now, this is something that crops up in an early scene in Hake Talbot's masterpiece Room of the Pit, and Holter does a similar thing where he's got an early seance, resolves it in a slightly different way. Now, it's not the main focus of the plot at all, but it hints that this guy has a really nice creative mind. There's a superb visual idea behind how the fourth door murder is pulled off. The impossible footprints, or the no footprints murder, is a little bit contrived, but again, it just shows a sense of what he's willing to go on and admit, and sort of how far he's willing to push something, and therefore what is possible inside of the universe, which I just bodes really well for everything that was going to come. Like, this is Paul Holter setting out the stall for what Paul Holter is going to be before he could even really say what Paul Holter was going to be, because obviously he hadn't written the books himself.
Next up, published in 1990, we have The Madman's Room, but only recently translated and republished.
Yeah, 2017 this was translated. Yeah.
Okay, so what's it all about, The Madman's Room?
Essentially, you know it's a good book because of how ridiculous it sounds.
Write that on the cover.
There is a room in an old-style English mansion, old family pile that's been passed down through however many generations, and on four separate occasions, in this room, in front of the fire, there is found a wet patch on the carpet. I mean, that's it. At the same time, somebody is usually found injured in the room. So there is something about that person being injured and the wet patches on the carpet that is obviously intrinsically linked.
Yeah.
There is no immediate way to discover how somebody with a wound to their head is causing a wet patch on the carpet. It's not blood, it's we presume water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a magnificent piece of construction. It is such a weird setup. And this is what I mean when I was saying about him finding these new little niches, these new little footprints inside of what's already gone on. To say this is a book where an injury is linked with a wet patch on a carpet in a room in a house just it sounds too stupid for words. But the way he draws you in and the way he builds up that sense of terror and that creeping sense of what the hell's going on. And there's never quite the same repetition of circumstances, but you always end up with somebody who's injured and there's a wet patch on the carpet.
Mm.
And it's as a piece of plotting, it is magisterial. It's honestly among the most tightly constructed plots I've read in years. And it just shows the impossibility element of it is fairly minor. It concerns a man who is able to predict the future. So there's an element of prophecy that we talked about last week that Holter has got into his work before. That's a fairly minor aspect of it. It's nicely resolved. It's a very nifty resolution, so I don't have any issue with it. But this central scheme, it's so lovely and focused. You've got that great clarity that the fourth door didn't quite have. Again, that lovely visual representation, and again, just this staggering originality that he brings to it's already quite an original problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then he resolves it in a way that it just binds around itself so tightly. It's phenomenal. It's really a phenomenal piece of work.
And then it's still contextualized by the sounds of it, again, in a room that kills, room that injures, room that's haunted, room that's, the madman's room. It's a really classic idea as well as being original.
And it's one of those, you're in a house, it's a family pile, so you've got the various members of the clan in there. Someone's got to be guilty of something. So it's that very closed circle, moving finger of suspicion thing.
Great.
But even then, I defy anybody to legitimately figure out what is going on.
Yeah, or call it a country house mystery, I guess.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's very true, yeah.
So why would you recommend this as a starter?
Because I think this shows that faith in him is not misplaced. That you're right to trust that when something seems a little bit off or a little bit odd, he's not gonna necessarily take the easy way out. He is actually constructing phenomenally beautifully. And so it's just fabulous because it highlights how well he controls every single element.
In at number three is The Tiger's Head, published in 1991. Give us the lowdown. What's The Tiger's Head all about?
The Tiger's Head is, again, a magnificent piece of plotting with how many pieces come together. But this time you have quite a large front and centre impossibility. And that the Tiger's Head is essentially some mystical artifact. It's a rod a couple of feet long with the head of a tiger on the end. And it is said to contain a genie. And one night, the guy who owns the Tiger's Head offers to show the genie to a guest who is visiting the town where he lives. They arrange for everybody else to leave the room, and people stand at the doors and at the window to ensure nobody can get in. And after a while, the room is re-entered because they haven't heard anything for a long time. They find the man who owned the Tiger's Head has been beaten to death. The guest who he was demonstrating the genie to is beaten unconscious, and when he comes around, he insists that the genie did come out of the tiger's head and attacked them both. On top of that, there is also a secondary plot involving someone called the suitcase killer, who is killing people, chopping up their bodies, and leaving the bits of the bodies in suitcases at train stations around the country. On top of that, there is also, in this town where the guy owns the tiger's head, there is a series of inexplicable thefts happening. So someone is stealing hats and things like this.
How many pages?
Yeah, well, and this is the
in
thing.
55 it's, pages.
It's 176, 180 pages, something
goodness
like that.
Me. Incredible.
But it's not overstuffed. Mm-hmm. And again, each of those elements, the stealing of the hats in particular, I love. It reminds me very much of, there's an Agatha Christie novel called Hickory Dickory Dock, where a series of things are stolen from a boarding house. And one of the things that gets stolen is a stethoscope. It's not a particularly highly regarded later Christie, but I love it, partly because of how brilliantly the stethoscope theft works into and enables so many other things. The hat theft in The Tiger's Head, it's the C, the D plot. It's a very minor element of it, but again, how it fits in and what it allows is just, it's that thing where he doesn't overstuff this one. Everything is weighed and everything is balanced.
And it's enriching everything.
Yes, everything, you know, it all pulls together. And it's really lovely to see the impossibility in such a tightly constructed plot be really front and centre. You know, with The Madman's Room, you could say, well, he just works in an impossibility, but it's a very minor part. So actually, we don't know that he can weave a big scale impossibility in really nicely. Whereas here, he really does. And you have to demystify this impossible attack in order to make sense of everything else.
So why this as a starter?
Again, partly for The Madman's Room, because it finally shows you how justified your faith in him is going to be. This one is more for people who want their impossibilities as well. So this is, if the minor impossible element of The Madman's Room, you're just like, well, I want to know how well he can work in a big scale impossibility. Also has a lovely floor plan as well. So if you're a fan of floor plans,
yeah.
Madman's Room has a floor plan. It's a little bit prosaic, but the floor plan here is lovely.
In at number four is The Seventh Hypothesis, published in 91, which you spoke a little bit about in the first episode as well, so obviously one you are keen on. Tell us about it.
This one, again, has a very minor impossibility element to it. There's a body appears in a dustbin quite early on, I think possibly even the very first chapter, and then later on you have a body disappearing from a particular context. What I love about this one is there's a real sense of sort of gloomy atmosphere. It's set in London in the 1930s, but you have people going around in the garb of the old-fashioned plague doctors with the long-nosed masks, and the cover depicts a man in this get-up being chased by what looks like the silhouettes of policemen. And it's this very gloomy, very sinister background to it of what these figures are doing and how they work and how one of them indeed vanishes. But on top of that, it is probably the book that contains the most twists per page of anything going. Because essentially, it is about two men, one of whom has committed a murder. And it's this back and forth between the two. It's that Lord Edgware dies thing where you know it has to be either this one or it has to be this one. Mm. And it's back and forth between the two. And it's really hard to do that well.
Yeah.
There are not very many classic titles that somebody can state of the which one of these two done it sub genre, I suppose it would be.
That's another podcast.
Yeah. If somebody wants to start that one, go for it. There are some, but there are not very many of them. And it's really hard to keep the finger of suspicion moving between six characters sometimes. But between two, where you know it's got to be one of them, is especially difficult.
And keeping it fresh the whole way through, yeah.
And there is this... There's an extended like set piece in this, which is just this conversation between these two men at one of their houses. One of them calls on the other at his house. And every single chapter... It flips, and then it flips.
Amazing.
And then it flips, and then it flips, and it just rolls out, and it just shows how quickly you can, when you're very intelligent in your structuring, how quickly you can change something. We can all cite, I mean, the classic example to go for, since we're talking about an author of Impossible Crimes, would be that revelation in the middle of Till Death Do Us Part by John Dixon Carr, where halfway Absolutely. Through, in the space of a sentence, everything changes.
Yeah.
Now, Holter does that here, and then he does it again 4 pages later, and then he does it again 5 pages later.
Great.
And it switches and switches and switches and switches, and the construction is so tight. It's just like, oh my God, like, oh my God, like, oh, and it's just hitting you with that surprise after surprise after surprise, and keeping that suspicion going back and forth. What's also quite nice is that the first impossibility is very solvable. And it's always nice when you're given something like that to kind of feel that you're a bit ahead of...
the game, yeah.
Yeah, and like that's quite good fun for people who are quite new to it to go, oh, well, okay, maybe it could have been done like this. It's phrased in quite a nice way. It's very fairly parsed.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's phrased in quite a nice way that it's very solvable. You're not told until the very end how it was done, but I think most people would figure it out quite early, and there's that aspect of feeling, not smug, but it's always enjoyable to feel that you've seen something and to feel quite... That's part of the joy of reading them, that working through and seeing if you've worked it out. And so there's slightly less going on in that early impossibility, which again shows how something can be achieved. You know, some people won't see it, and it just shows how something can be achieved quite nicely with a clever piece of phrasing or a clever allusion or something to misdirect you. But for people who do see it, there's that, oh yeah, okay, cool, I can see how this works. And so for that switchback and for just seeing how really tightly constructed this is, particularly because... I do think the art of legitimately tight plot construction is something that has been lost. And it's just lovely to see this just knocked back and forth. It's like the craziest game of tennis you've ever seen.
And is that the reason you would call it out as one to start?
Yeah, it's just fun. It's really good fun. It's just a tremendous laugh. And you can just see him sitting there. Again, as I said last episode, you can just see him sitting there going, oh, that'll be fun. Let's see if we can make that happen.
Yeah. And then do it again.
And then do it again, and then do it again, and then do it again. Yeah, it's a really, really, really enjoyable, just surprise after surprise after surprise fest.
And last but not least, in at number 5 is The Invisible Circle, published originally in 1996. Tell us about it.
I like to think most impossible crime novels are like a cake, and if you get the balance of ingredients right, you end up and you cook it correctly and you come at it in the right frame of mind and all of that, you get this amazing cake out of it.
Mm-hmm.
This one is a trifle, because trifle is more fun than cake. It's not taking itself seriously. There's a piece of misdirection that a lot of people are just like, well, I saw through that. It's, yeah, fine, great, that happens sometimes. And again, like we talked about the characters being something that people criticise, it's almost, I feel sometimes as if the criticism Holter comes in for is weirdly magnified because it's Paul Holter. And there seems to be maybe it's just me being oversensitive, but there seems to be this very reactionary, well, I saw through that piece of misdirection. I can't believe that people wouldn't see through it. It's like,
right,
yeah, great,
right.
But that's happened in a book before.
Yeah.
You've read other books where you've seen through the misdirection. So?
Yeah.
You know, all right, great, then stop reading. But whatever, I saw through the misdirection in one book. I'm never reading a book ever again. Just, you know, dust yourself off and get on with it. And I don't think it's supposed to be taken seriously. It has a man impossibly stabbed through a window where the mesh is too small to admit a sword,
okay,
at the top of a castle overlooking the sea, where they're isolated from the mainland because the bridge collapses, and he's, again, like with the fourth door, waxed in and it's sealed and locked with a chain, and he's got the Holy Grail in the room with him, and when they come back he doesn't have the Holy Grail with the room in him, and the sword that he stabbed with was fixed in a stone and it couldn't be pulled out of the stone, and they've all signed the scabbard, like the hand guard thing, and the stone's been pushed into the sea, so somebody had to impossibly get the sword out of the stone that's in the sea and impossibly stab it through a window, impossibly at the top of an impossibly inaccessible impossible tower. It's not Chekhov. It's just fun. It's just fun. It's a great one. I work as a teacher and I give quite a lot of books to students as prizes. I have given this book as a prize more than any other book to my students, and they love it.
Yeah.
They love it. It's a really accessible, if you have not read any of this kind of stuff before and you just want a sense of what is a historical mystery and what is an impossible crime novel and what is an isolated set of suspects and what is all of the different things that these novels can do, but you don't want to run the risk of ending up with something wearying and something that's just isolates people on an island really turgidly, because we always go to And Then There Were None, which is brilliant, but there are also novels, I shall demur from naming any, where people are isolated on an island and that does anything, and then people die and you're like, oh well, he's the killer, goodo. So this assumption that these things are always easy to do and are always blistering fun, actually there's a risk that you're going to give someone something that's actually quite dull. This is just fun because of the crazy mix of ingredients. There's one impossible disappearance on it that I'm not a huge fan of, but I'll forgive it that, because it has people from Arthurian mythology impossibly stabbing someone at the top of a I could go through it all again. It's of all of the books, it's the one that you should take the least seriously and just go, reading is fun, reading is something I do for enjoyment, and I am going to enjoy this, and it is just let it go and you'll tear through it. And it just shows Holter, I think, probably at his most playful, for all of his narrative construction tricks that he has. And all of his, he frequently tries to kind of work in a twist in the last line. This is him at his most playful. It's just a toy box. He's got his Lego castle out and he's just gone for it. Yes, it does something which is easier to do in print than it would be in physical form. But, you know, that's the whole point. Books do stuff in print that you can't get away with visually because they're a print medium.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are the five. They all sound so super intriguing and I'm so drawn into each of them. But in case a listener didn't want to jump in straight with a full-length novel, you mentioned in the last episode that Holter has written a number of collections of short stories. You've got one here which is called The Night of the Wolf. And are there any notable stories from The Night of the Wolf that you would draw out for people to give a go with Holter in a short story?
Yeah, it's a very strong collection all the way through, actually. But if I had to pick probably the top three, I talked in the previous episode about The Cleaver, which is a prophetic dream, which is just ingeniously clever. I talked in the last episode about The Night of the Wolf, that evinces a particular framing that Holter quite likes that seems to put people's backs up, but it seems kind of harmless to me, and the impossibility is superb. I'd also be inclined to go for The Dead Dance at Night, because that's a really spooky but very nicely resolved coffins moving around in a crypt. And it's just a lovely, short, simple story. I mean, I have reviewed Night of the Wolf. There is the reviewer somewhere on my blog, so you can go through and find my thoughts on all the individual stories. But I think those three are especially good for someone to start with, because they again, demonstrate in a relatively compact way quite a clear idea and how to go about killing somebody or how to go about achieving something impossible.
I mean, I'm in an interesting position here. I'm talking about an author that I've never read, but I have a funny experience of, in a way, now that you've mentioned it. And as someone who's never read someone's work, what draws me in about Holter is, as you say, the ingenuity of the ideas. And as for many of us who love Golden Age detective fiction, impossible crime fiction, it's, I don't want to say the hook, but it's the hook plus the context. The way that you've presented those is just, those are the kind of things that I won't be able to stop thinking about until I've read it. And that, for me, I can already see that he's obviously a good writer, because if in someone explaining the simple premise of the impossibility and the plot of the book to you draws you in that much, well, obviously it's going to be worth giving a go.
It is to be hoped.
Indeed.
We all know it doesn't always work out like that.
Yes. Well, as always, listeners, thanks for tuning in. Thanks for joining us on our journey through Paul Holter. And we look forward to talking to you next time.
Yeah, see you in a couple of months.